This is The Stark Truth, hosted by Robert Stark, brought to you by StarkTruthRadio.com. Robert Stark is an American journalist and political commentator. You can listen to his podcast at www.StarkTruthRadio.com.
This is Robert Stark. I'm joined here with Lynn Zook. She has a new book out, Gambling on a Dream, the classic Las Vegas Strip, 1956 to 1973, which is a second volume to her first book. Lynn, it's great having you back on the show.
Ah, thank you. It's great to be back.
In case our audience didn't hear the original interview, do you want to briefly go over the era that your original book was about? It was about primarily the 1940s to early 50s?
Yes, the first book covered the Las Vegas Strip from the 1930s through 1955 and all the hotels that were built on the famed boulevard during those years. So this one picks up right where the other one left off, and we cover the hotels built from 1956 to 1973, or as I like to say, from conception to implosion, with a few survival stories. Readers get a detailed history of each of the hotels.
Would you say the years covered in the second book that just came out are more crucial?
There are more of them that are still standing then from the first book, because the second book covers such icons as Caesar's Palace and the original MGM Grand, which of course is now Bally's, the International, which is now, I believe, the Westin. And so there are more of those the hotels built during Volume 2 that are still standing than Volume 1.
Oh, you were saying there's not a single hotel from Volume 1 that's standing?
No, there are still a few. Most significantly, the Flamingo.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah. But, you know, the Tropicana is still standing. Circus Circus is still standing from Volume 2. So, you know, part of that is just they were built, Caesar's Palace and Circus Circus were built in the late 60s, whereas the Tropicana was built in the late 50s. And so, you know, she's survived a lot, that girl has.
So you're a Las Vegas native. Can you talk about your background and what about these hotels appeals to you personally?
I grew up in Las Vegas. My family moved there when I was very young, just as the 1960s were dawning. And for a number of years, my mother was a showroom waitress up and down the Strip. And ultimately, she helped to open Caesar's Palace, the Circus Maximus, the showroom there. And so I got to see a number of shows, either down front or from the wings of the stage, thanks to her. And it was also thanks to her that my dad and my mom and I saw Elvis Presley when he returned for his triumphant, his triumphant return in 1969 at the original International Hotel.
And was this the era that was known as the Rat Pack era?
Frank Sinatra, Frank and Sammy and Dean, the real Rat Pack era is the late 50s, the early 60s, especially at the Sands Hotel. but they continued to perform at various hotels throughout the 60s and into the 70s, and, you know, for the rest of their careers.
And the Sands, was that covered in this book, or that was from your previous book?
That's in Volume 1, but there are plenty of Sinatra stories, because after he had his big blow-up at the Sands with, or at the Sands with Carl Cohen, he moved over to Caesar's Palace, and so there's a number of Sinatra stories about him butting heads with the people in charge at Caesar's.
Was this era the beginning of the Vegas shows, or was that era started in your previous volume?
This was when the showrooms truly came of age. It was the 1960s. There were variety shows all over the TV. Of course, back then there were only three networks, and there were no VCRs or DVRs, and so people had to watch in real time, and you saw your favorite performer, whether it was Frank or Dean or Lena Horne or Harry Belafonte. You would see them perform on these variety shows, and the logical idea was, let's go to Vegas and see them in person, because they had these intimate showrooms, and you could go for a dinner show or a late show. And you went to the dinner show, you paid about $15. You got dinner, you got dessert, you got a couple of drinks. You know, you can't beat that with a stick. Of course, back then, $15 was a lot of money. But it was when the showrooms truly came of age, and, I mean, just the amount of star power up and down that boulevard when I was growing up was just amazing.
Were these hotels that were built in the 50s, 60s, and into the 70s, were they much smaller than the ones that are built more recently?
To a degree, yes. They were also much more open in terms of spaciousness. There were, you know, landscaped grounds and a pool area, and very lushly landscaped, and, you know, you didn't have to walk 5 miles to your room. Now, today, you know, they're built out right to the curb, and some hotels have, you know, over 1,000 rooms and stuff, and it's now much bigger. Back then, it was a much more intimate experience. You know, if you stayed at a hotel enough times, the staff knew who you were, they knew what you liked, they catered to you. You don't get that as much anymore unless you're a high roller.
Would you say the original hotels were a lot more architecturally interesting?
Oh, most definitely. Each one, you know, was a different theme, and it was the heyday of mid-century modern architecture. You know, the Tropicana had that beautiful fountain out front. You know, it looked like, you know, Miami Beach had come to Las Vegas. And you had the dunes, and, of course, there was neon everywhere back then. And those neon signs were huge, and they were animated, and they moved, and they changed colors. And driving down the boulevard was a very different experience than it is today. Back then, it wasn't so much bumper to bumper. Also, too, back then, you dressed up. Nobody went to a casino in shorts and flip-flops. You dress to go out.
Yeah, I definitely noticed that people are really casual in Las Vegas today. Do people also dress differently than they would have back home?
Yeah, people, women especially, wore outfits that, you know, they would never wear at home, but it was acceptable in Las Vegas. You know, lots of sparkles, low-cut gowns, minks, plenty of jewelry, men in suits and ties, sometimes tuxedos, depending on where you were going.
Was this the beginning of the Sin City era, and was this a very kind of adult-oriented era?
It was very adult. Though Las Vegas, you know, was known as America's playground back in the 1960s and through the early 70s, it was basically an adult playground. The Hacienda had a family-oriented vibe to it. The International had a youth hotel. So they did a couple of the hotel, and of course Circus with the circus acts.
Was Circus the first family-oriented hotel?
No, the Hacienda actually beat them to the punch, but Circus magnified their family theme times 10, and, you know, with the circus acts and the clowns and Narbo, the ape man, and all of that. But you had other hotels like Caesar's Palace, who had, you know, had the Bacchanal room with the wine goddesses who would, you know, massage your temples or massage your shoulders and, you know, just, you know, cater to the clientele like no tomorrow. So it was a mixture, but it was mainly an adult playground. And Las Vegas, you know, with the help of the News Bureau and some intrepid reporters, played that angle up big time.
Can you describe the aesthetics of the original Caesar's Palace? There was a turquoise lighting, water features, and the interiors as well.
Yeah. The front of Caesar's was absolutely beautiful. It glowed turquoise at night, and it had from the porte cochere out to the street, it had a line of fountains that changed colors at night. You know, the fountains were fully functional, and it was just a beautiful, beautiful hotel. And back then, it had the Sarno block on the front of it, and the interior. It was, until the original MGM Grand was built, probably the most lavish hotel on the strip.
Is some of the original neon signage from the original Caesar's Palace, is some of it at the museum?
I believe it is. I know the Stardust letters are at the Neon Museum. Trying to think of some of the Hacienda Horse and Rider is at the Neon Museum. It's been restored, and it rides above Fremont Street, right there where Fremont and Vegas Boulevard come together.
With Caesar's Palace, does any of the original remain on site?
The original building is still there, and the Oval Casino is still there. And if you know where to look, you can see remnants of it. With all the additions that they've made over the years, I like to refer to it as the Winchester Mystery House of Hotels on the Strip, because it's, you know, you never know which tower is which or anything like that. But another hotel that has a lot of remnants of its original bones is the original MGM Grand, which, as I said, is now Bally's. The interior of that, despite the fire, is still mainly intact.
So that was Bally's. It was remodeled into Bally's in the 80s?
Yeah, Bally's took it over a year or two after the fire in 1980.
How much of the exterior remains?
The exterior is still pretty intact. Where they used to have parking in the front, that's all taken out, and they've got that walkway that connects them to the corner. But, you know, they still have the shops downstairs, even though they're not nearly as elegant as they were back in the 70s. They had a movie theater down there that played MGM Studio Prince, and the bill changed every week. And years later in the 1990s and the early 2000s, it was turned into a comedy club, and now I believe it's a sports bar.
Was the original MGM Grand, was that the first skyscraper on the Strip?
No, that was actually the first skyscraper topped out at 9 stories, and that was the Riviera. But the MGM Grand and the Landmark was also the first, not the Landmark, but the International was billed as the first mega resort. Kirk Kerkorian built both the original International and the original MGM Grand Hotel. And he had a penchant for big.
With his other surviving hotels, the Tropicana and the Riviera, how much of the original, would you say those two are, for the most part, preserve a lot of the original?
The Riviera was in in good shape in terms of...
Sorry, I meant the two surviving ones, the Tropicana and Circus.
The Tropicana is still... parts of the interior are still there, if you know where to look. They were one of the last hotels to still have their garden rooms up until a few years ago, until they tore those out. Those were the low-slung motel rooms that used to surround the pool. But, if you know where to look, you can see pieces of, like I said, both Caesars and the original MGM Grand, the International, and, of course, Circus Circus.
So Circus Circus, did that undergo a major renovation, or is that mostly original?
The original building is still pretty much intact. It opened with no hotel rooms, and so it struggled for a number of years until William Bennett and his partner bought out Jay Sarno, and the first thing they did was put in a hotel tower. And during their ownership, I think they added at least 2, if not 3, more towers.
Would you say those two, the Tropicana and Circus Circus, are in most danger of being demolished or renovated?
Only because the various owners that Caesars has had over the years certainly understand that brand. And so it is, of all of the ones built built between 1956 and 1973, it is probably the most successful and the least likely. So Circus Circus is, you know, struggling. The Tropicana struggles, and Bally's. So it's, you know, it's kind of hit and miss.
In your book, do you also go into some smaller, more obscure hotels and casinos?
Not necessarily, only because there was so much history just on the remaining hotels that were built during that classic era. Because the classic Las Vegas era basically came to an end by the mid to late 70s.
In your book, you do talk about the game creator of the game Yahtzee. He created a hotel based on the... It was based on a Tudor English theme, but that was a hotel that had no casino.
Yes, that was became the Aladdin Hotel. Ultimately, it was originally called the Tally Ho, and it was envisioned and built by the guy that knew the couple that had created Yahtzee, and he marketed it and made a fortune, and then turned his eye to Las Vegas and decided that would be the perfect place to have a hotel without a casino. And that didn't go over very successfully. It had another owner after that, and then finally Milton Prell, who had grown tired of retirement, came back to Las Vegas and bought it and turned it into the Aladdin, which was a wonderful hotel for its day. Had that wonderful neon sign out front. that looked, the designers all referred to it as the ice cream chair, because it just, you know, it was all neon and filigree and just a beautiful sight.
And you also talk about the Sahara in the book?
The Sahara was in Volume 1, because Milton Perel had built a Sahara, there's part of that also in the history of the Aladdin because of Milton Perel.
Was it because they both kind of have Arabian themes?
Yeah, Milton Perel, for some reason, truly liked that Arabian theme and ran with it both at the Sahara and at the Aladdin. And I would be remiss in talking about neon if we didn't talk about the Stardust Hotel with its original facade, which was the entire galaxy in neon. It was designed by Kermit Wayne of Yesco, and it was, for its day, probably the most beautiful neon signage on the Las Vegas Strip.
That one survives at the Neon Museum. Has there ever been talk about displaying some of these signs along Las Vegas Boulevard?
Not that I'm aware of. I do the Stardust letters, both the Jetson font and the later Helvetica font, are at the museum. But the Stardust sign itself, the big one that they put up in the 1970s and was there and, until they imploded the property in the 2000s, that was too large to move. To the Neon Museum. You would have had to cut it up, and then there would have been no way to put it back together. Same thing happened with the Dune sign.
There was no way to save it. I think there are a few smaller signs near Fremont Street and on along Las Vegas Boulevard. I forget which ones that they display there.
Yes. They've got a couple of motel signs on Fremont Street. They have the Haciendas, Horse and Rider, which Brian Lemming did. Further down Las Vegas Boulevard, by closer to the Neon Museum, they've put up a couple of restored signs. The smaller sign, the flasher bulb sign for the Landmark, sits where in the parking lot where the Landmark used to sit. It's used for parking for the convention center now.
Did they save the original Marge Williams sign from the Riviera, the really big, opulent one?
I believe they saved pieces of it from that neon facade that she designed. It's my understanding that pieces of it did go to the Neon Museum.
That was the one, briefly, it was next to the gas station?
That was the entire, that whole neon facade with the stars.
There were the stars that were along the front, then on the opposite end. There was another older sign on the opposite end, but I forget the name.
That sign was designed by Ben Chapman, and it sat, if we're talking about the same one that used to sit on Paradise behind the hotel.
And was that one saved?
They got pieces of it. It's very hard to save large neon signs like that intact, only because taking them apart to transport them is next to impossible.
And those parts, are they on display at the museum?
I believe so. I know the Neon Museum has night tours, which sound really, you know, really beautiful, where you can see some of the signs, not with the neon, because they're still in the process of restoring them. But I highly recommend the nighttime tours.
Do you think Las Vegas has a lack of historic preservation because it's such a new city as opposed to, say, New York or San Francisco?
I think Las Vegas has always struggled. Being such a young city, it has always struggled with historic preservation, and part of that is because every few years the city reinvents itself. And back in the 60s and the 70s and the 80s, it was a little easier to save historic buildings because the town was smaller and there were more people that, you know, lived there, had grown up there, that sort of thing. In the late 90s, with the big building boom, they had, you know, a million people came from someplace else, and they didn't necessarily think of Las Vegas as, you know, their hometown. And Las Vegas has never done a really good job of making its history important. Everybody, you know, everybody knows about the Strip, and they know about downtown to a lesser extent, but they don't know about the historic neighborhoods and the fact that, you know, the Boulevard Mall was, you know, the first mall, second indoor big mall that we had. The first one was the Charleston Plaza Mall. And, you know, you don't know that unless you lived there back then or you grew up there.
Do you talk about the Palace Station, which is currently being renovated?
No, because that one was off the Strip. That was originally it was called the Bingo Palace, and it was one of the first neighborhood casinos that went in.
In the book, do you go into the role of the mob in financing the casinos?
Oh, most definitely, and especially in terms of the Stardust. And I've got some great stories about Frank Rosenthal and Tony Spilotro. The former U.S. Attorney Milan Brown and journalist Gwen Castaldi both talk a great deal about the whole effort to rid the Strip of the mob influenced by the late 70s, the early 1980s.
What have been some of the most recent trends going on in Las Vegas? Has the whole building boom pretty much slowed down?
It did during the Great Recession. It appears to be picking back up. But Las Vegas always finds a way to reinvent itself through good times and bad times. You know, today the majority of people don't go to gamble. They go, you know, they go for the fine dining and the shopping, which, you know, if you had told us that, you know, 40, 50 years ago, we would have laughed in your face because everybody went to Vegas to gamble because Nevada was, back then, Nevada was the only state where legalized gaming, or where gaming was legalized.
Are there some hotels or casinos that we didn't touch upon yet?
Not that. I think we covered just about all of them.
Who designed the book cover? It's really excellent.
Oh, thank you. That is a graphic artist that I work with. Her name is Joanna Arlukowitz. And she designed both book covers as well as my original website. And when I revamped it last year, she did that one as well. So if you like it, be sure you check out my website, classiclasvegas.com.
And your next book, is that going to be on Fremont Street?
Yes. My next book is going to cover Fremont Street and downtown. There will be a early history of Fremont Street because that is in many ways where, you know, Las Vegas began. And it's, you know, it is kind of the quintessential Las Vegas story where, you know, a lot of boom time, good times, bad times, struggling times. It's all encapsulated in downtown and Fremont Street.
And that area, there's been some demolitions I think the Fitzgerald was taken down, but for the most part, that area is still, there's still a ton of original stuff there.
Up until a few years ago, there was, but now, you know, some new owners have gone in, and Four Queens and a couple of other Binion's, or the original Horseshoe Club, you know, they're renovating and without an eye towards preservation, which is one reason why I absolutely adore the El Cortez, because they understand. They market their history, and they market it well, and the work they've done on the hotel has not altered the look or feel of the hotel.
Yeah, I visited the El Cortez. It does feel pretty close to how you would have imagined it to originally be. What was mm-hmm. That was covered in your first book.
No, that one will be covered in the next one, when I cover downtown.
And with those hotels you mentioned, the Four Queens, Binion's, are they taking down the neon marquees, or they're mostly just renovating the interiors?
I haven't been downtown in a while, only because, you know, ever since, I've never been a big fan of the canopy, because I loved it when you could drive up and down Fremont Street and it was like being in a canyon of neon. But I believe the facades are also getting altered.
Are you going to write a book about the era from 1974 to the late 80s?
For the Strip?
Yeah, for the Strip.
No, because Volume 2, basically, because between the opening of the original MGM Grand in 1973, there wasn't a new hotel built on the Strip until Steve Wynn opened the Mirage in, I believe it was the late 80s. I think it was 1986, but I'll say the late 80s. So there wasn't a lot that went on the Strip.
We're getting close to the end of the show. Do you want to let our audience know where they can get your book in case they're interested in checking it out?
I hope they're interested in checking it out. It is available on iTunes, on Amazon, and on Barnes & Noble. It is an ebook only, but if you go to my website, classiclasvegas.com, there are links that will take you directly to the various vendors, and I hope your readers enjoy it.
Lynn Zook, it's been an excellent show. Thank you so much for being on.
Oh, thank you, and hopefully I can come back when I've finished the Fremont Street book.
And when do you estimate that will be out?
That'll be out probably in the summer, fall of 2019.
Thanks again for being on. Take care.
Thank you. I appreciate it.